I want you to picture something for a second. Imagine a structure that is, well, arguably the backbone of the modern industrial world.
Okay.
It's thousands of kilometers long, it crosses ocean floors, cuts through deserts, winds over mountain ranges. It is the global energy lifeline.
You're talking about pipelines.
I am. And from the outside, they look invincible, right?
Mm.
Just these massive, endless tubes of high-strength steel.
Brute force engineering, that's what you see.
Exactly. But here's the thing that keeps engineers awake at night. The integrity of that massive scale hinges on details that are so small you can't even see them with a standard microscope.
It's the classic engineering paradox, isn't it? The largest structures are often at the mercy of the microscopic.
Get the atoms wrong, and the kilometers don't matter.
They really don't.
And today, we're going to look at that paradox through a very specific lens. We got a stack of research here centered around a doctoral dissertation by Yan Pei from the University of Cambridge.
Right. It's titled High-Frequency Induction Welding and Post-Welding Heat Treatment of Steel Pipes.
I know. It sounds a little dry.
It does. But having gone through it, it reads more like a forensic investigation. It's a detective story about why, despite all our advanced technology, the seam of a pipe, the weld, remains this stubborn, mysterious weak point.
And that is the mission for this deep dive. We're unpacking the Pei analysis. We need to figure out why high-tech steel sometimes refuses to behave and what happens when you have a flaw that standard tests just miss.
And we should clarify the stakes here. This isn't about a leaky pipe under your sink.
No.
We're talking catastrophic failure, specifically in what the industry calls sour service environments.
Sour service? That sounds ominous.
It is. It means you're transporting oil or gas with hydrogen sulfide in it, H2S. It's highly corrosive, toxic, and it actively tries to destroy the steel from the inside out.
So if that weld has even a tiny flaw.
A microscopic memory of a flaw, yeah. The pipe can essentially unzip.
Memory of a flaw. That's a phrase we're going to come back to because it is absolutely central to Pei's findings. So let's start where the metal starts, on the factory floor.
Sounds good.
I think most people, myself included, might assume a pipe is just cast, like pouring molten metal into a tube mold.
That's a reasonable assumption, but no. Not for this level of engineering. Mm-hmm. For these high-strength lines, specifically using a steel grade called X65, it's the industry workhorse. It actually starts as a giant flat plate.
A hot rolled plate.
Yeah.
So you've just got this massive thick sheet of steel.
Exactly. Imagine taking a thick sheet of paper and just curling it until the long edges touch. That's the basic idea. But to seal that seam, you have to fuse it at an atomic level.
And for that, they use a process called high-frequency induction welding, HFI.
This is where the physics gets really cool. Pei's research describes this V shape where the edges meet, and they use electricity in a very, very clever way.
Not a torch.
No torch. It's all about two phenomena. The first is called the skin effect.
Which, if I'm getting this right, means the electricity is kind of lazy.
In a way, yeah. When you run high-frequency alternating current through metal, the electrons don't want to flow through the middle. They get pushed to the outside. They hug the surface, the skin.
So you're not wasting energy heating the whole pipe. You're just concentrating all that power right on the edges you need to weld.
Precisely. It creates this superheated skin. And then you've got the proximity effect.
Okay.
The current is flowing in opposite directions on the two facing edges, one going up, one coming down. Electromagnetically, they attract each other.
Ah, so it concentrates the heat even more right at the point of that V.
Exactly where you need it. So you've got these two white-hot edges rushing toward each other. And then comes the most vital step, the squeeze.
The squeeze is everything.
It is. You have these huge pressure rolls that push the molten edges together with immense force. And the goal isn't just to touch, it's to forge. You're literally squeezing the melted material out.
Like squeezing a jelly donut.
A bit violent, but yes. That liquid metal has impurities and oxides, the bad stuff. You squeeze it out so the solid, clean metal behind it can fuse together.
Okay, so it sounds like a perfect system. You heat with precision, squeeze out the junk, you should have a solid pipe. But this is where Pei's research comes in. The problem of the brittle junction.
This is the core problem. HFI welding is fast, it's efficient, but the joint it creates often has low toughness.
Okay, we should probably clarify toughness here. Because in normal life, we use it interchangeably with strength or hardness.
They're very different. Hardness is resistance to scratching. A diamond is hard. Strength is how much load it can take before it bends or breaks. But toughness.
Toughness is how much energy it can absorb before it snaps.
Exactly. Think of a glass window versus a car tire. The glass is hard, but hit it with a hammer and it shatters. Zero toughness. The tire absorbs the impact. You want your pipeline to be the tire.
And they test this with the Charpie V-notch test.
Yeah, which is as low-tech as it sounds. You cut a notch in a piece of the weld and you hit it with a giant pendulum hammer.
And if the hammer swings right through, that's bad.
That's bad. That means your steel is brittle. You want the steel to absorb the blow and slow the hammer down.
And P notes that in these welds, they often find a decarburized zone. The carbon is literally burned away.
The heat is so intense it can cause the carbon to diffuse out. You can lose up to 30%. Less carbon often means a softer structure, which sounds good, but the rapid cooling creates a chaotic microstructure that's actually brittle.
But wait, the industry knows this. Welding makes steel brittle. That's why they have a second step, right? The post-welding heat treatment, PWHT.
That's the standard fix. Immediately after welding, further down the line, they use induction coils to heat the seam back up.
This is the reset button.
That's the theory. You heat it up to around 950 degrees Celsius to normalize it. You're trying to wipe the slate clean, erase the chaotic weld structure, and grow a new, uniform, tough structure.
But here is the twist. And it's the whole reason we're doing this deep dive. Sometimes the reset button doesn't work.
That is the mystery. You weld it, you heat treat it. And when you run that Charpie test, the metal still just snaps. The toughness hasn't improved at all.
The metal is refusing to be fixed.
It's refusing to forget the trauma of the weld. And that kicks off the investigation. P lays out the usual suspects, the things engineers normally blame.
Okay, let's run through the lineup. Suspect number one, the dirt. Or, technically, inclusions.
Right. This goes back to the squeeze. If you don't squeeze hard enough, you can get penetrator defects, little bits of trapped oxides, iron oxide, manganese oxide.
And sulfur is a big one, right? Manganese sulfide.
Oh, M&S inclusions are nasty. They get stretched out into long strings during rolling, and they're basically like a perforation, an easy place for a crack to start.
But the research is pretty clear. Modern X65 steel is incredibly clean.
It is. The sulfur content is down to like 0.005 weight percent. It's vanishingly small. So while inclusions can be a problem, they don't explain this persistent brittleness in clean steel.
So it's not the dirt. Okay. Suspect number two, grain size. I remember the Hall-Pitch relation from physics. Smaller grains mean tougher metal.
Correct. Think of the grains as a maze. A crack wants to travel in a straight line, but when it hits a grain boundary, it has to change direction.
So more boundaries, smaller grains means the crack burns more energy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the engineers look under a standard microscope. They check the metallographic grain size, what they can see.
Hey.
And it looks fine. The grains appear small. The heat treatment seems to have worked.
So the steel is clean. The grains look small. But the hammer still snaps it. This is where P's dissertation just drops the bomb.
This is the aha moment. P's breakthrough was realizing the problem isn't the metallographic grain size, it's the crystallographic grain size.
Okay, those sound way too similar. You're gonna have to unpack that for me.
Let's use an analogy. Imagine you're looking at a wooden floor made of hundreds of small parquet tiles.
Okay.
You look down, you see all the lines between the tiles, that's your metallographic view. You see, look, lots of small tiles, small grains.
Right. I see the boundaries.
What if I told you that even though they are separate tiles, the wood grain in every single tile is pointing in the exact same direction.
Oh. So if I took an axe to that floor, it wouldn't matter that there are hundreds of tiles. The split would just run straight through all of them.
Exactly. To a crack, those hundreds of small tiles behave like one giant continuous plank of wood. The crack doesn't care about the visible boundary. It follows the crystal alignment, the texture.
That is terrifying. Mm. So the standard microscope sees the lines and says, all good. But the crack sees the alignment and says, open road.
That's what Pei found using a technique called EBSD electron backscatter diffraction. It actually maps the orientation of the crystal lattice.
And what does it find?
It found that the cleavage planes, the natural splitting planes in the iron crystal, were lining up across multiple grains. The metal was secretly organized to fail.
But hold on. The heat treatment, the reset button, is supposed to scramble all that. That's the whole point. Why didn't it work?
And now we meet the true villain of the story. He calls it the austenite memory effect.
Memory of steel. That sounds like a fantasy novel.
It's a very real, very frustrating phenomenon in metallurgy. When you heat the steel up to fix it, the process of austenitization, you expect it to form new, random, round grains. A fresh start.
But it doesn't get one.
No. Instead of forming nice new round grains, the new structure forms as needle-shaped crystals, acicular austenite. And crucially, they start growing on the boundaries of the old structure.
Wait, so it's literally rebuilding the old broken house on the exact same foundation?
That's a perfect way to put it. The metal remembers its previous coarse structure from the weld and just reconstitutes it. The heat treatment, which was meant to destroy the bad texture, accidentally regenerates it.
That's just maddening. Why? What triggers this memory?
It's often stabilized by tiny particles of alloying elements, things like niobium or vanadium carbides. They're put in there to make the steel strong, but here they act as anchors.
Anchor.
They pin the old grain boundaries in place. They effectively tell the new structure, nope, you grow right here, don't move. They prevent the new grains from becoming random.
So the very elements that give the steel its high strength are helping it hold on to this bad memory.
It's a painful trade-off. And there's another accomplice P identified. The MA constituent.
The MA constituent. Sounds like a secret agency.
Martensite austenite islands, they're just little pockets of very hard, brittle phases that form during rapid cooling.
And hard means brittle. They're crack starters.
Exactly. And Pei observed something very specific. Strings of these MA islands running through the middle of the pipe wall.
Strings? Like a pearl necklace of defects.
Pretty much. A string of brittle islands combined with that aligned crystal texture we just talked about. You've basically built a highway for a crack to travel down.
Okay, so invisible grain alignment, a memory effect that undoes the fix, and strings of brittle islands. But let's bring this back to the why should I care factor.
Yeah.
Sour service.
Right. This is where it gets real. Sour gas, as you said, has hydrogen sulfide. In that environment, tiny hydrogen atoms can actually slip inside the solid steel. They infiltrate the metal lattice.
Like water soaking into a sponge.
A malicious sponge. The hydrogen atoms then look for traps. And those MA islands, those inclusions, they're perfect traps. Hydrogen gathers there.
And when enough of them gather?
They combine to form hydrogen gas molecules, H2. The gas expands and the pressure builds up from inside the steel.
A slow motion explosion inside the wall of the pipe.
Precisely. It's called hydrogen-induced cracking, or HIC. Now, if your steel is tough and uniform, it might withstand that internal pressure. But if you have that invisible weakness, that aligned wood grain...
The hydrogen just tears it apart.
It rips right through. The pipe cracks from the inside out. And since the pipeline itself is under high pressure, that crack can propagate for miles.
A complete nightmare. And it all traces back to that invisible memory in the weld. So, did P offer a solution? Can we make the steel forget?
The dissertation proposes modified post-welding heat treatments.
Which means what? Just turn the oven up higher?
It's a delicate balance. You have to find a specific temperature and cooling rate to break that memory effect. You need to get it hot enough to dissolve those little anchors, the niobium carbides, so the grains are finally free to rearrange themselves properly.
But not so hot that you ruin the steel in other ways.
Exactly. Go too hot and you get massive grains, which makes the steel weak in a different way. It's like a very precise culinary recipe for steel. You have to coax it into letting go of its past.
It's amazing to think about the journey we just went on. We started with a pipeline spanning a continent. We zoomed into the welding machine.
Down to the grains.
And finally down to the invisible alignment of the crystal lattice itself.
It really shows that modern engineering isn't just about what you can see. The integrity of our global energy infrastructure depends on understanding the personality of the material.
Personality is a great word for it, because what really stood out to me was this concept of material memory.
It really challenges our perception of inanimate objects.
It does. We think of memory as biological in our brains or digital on a hard drive. But here's steel, cold, hard, inanimate steel. And yet, it remembers the trauma of being welded.
And it actively resists changing. It wants to go back to what it was.
Exactly. It refuses to forget, even when we blast it with heat to try and change it. It just makes you wonder.
About what?
Well, about what else is out there remembering. If a piece of steel can hold a grudge against the welding machine, how many other engineering failures are just cases of materials refusing to forget?
That's a thought that will make me look at bridges and buildings a little differently from now on.
On that slightly unsettling note, we'll wrap up this deep dive into the invisible memory of steel. Thanks for listening, and until next time, keep looking beneath the surface.